was born out of a conversation that started when I interviewed some leaders of Contralesa, really because I was lamenting the death of young African boys at various initiation schools, some legal, some not. And I was quite frankly miffed at the fact that there was no outrage about the fact that every single year, at least for as long as I've been doing this, for the last 10 years, every single year, predictably, there have been boys that have died or have been maimed beyond any redemption because of botched circumcisions. And I was angry at the fact that there was no anger about it. I was angry at the fact that it is a predictable occurrence every year that there are going to be kids who are going to die one or other initiation school. And I was angry about that. And of course, we invited the people from Contralesa, and we then conceived of the idea to have an hour every 2 weeks where we look at an aspect of African culture, African custom that we could expand our understanding on. And today we're going to be speaking about the custom or the practice of polygamy here on the African continent, and perhaps here in South Africa amongst the various ethnic groups here in our country. Reminding my listeners to say that polygamy is a universally practiced practice. I mean, you go anywhere in the world, you'll find it. In fact, in some other countries, you find where people practice polyandry, yeah, which is where women have more than one husband. So that thing is, yeah, power to the girls. So we want to explore again. I want to say we want to learn, not fight, but learn and understand about what are the principles, what are the philosophies, what are the theologies, what are the worldviews that are behind a particular practice. And of course, today we're going to be talking about polygamy. Now, you might think it's right or you might think it's wrong. But that's fine. That's you. That's what you... But we want to understand it, how it works. Yeah? And then we're also going to talk about how the South African constitution as it is at the moment, the laws that flow from that constitution, how they interpret and how they work with some of these customs, so that we can understand how that which belongs to a particular indigenous custom fits with what some might call a modern constitution. And I have two eminent guests here, Professor Hau Ngubane, cultural expert and professor at African languages at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and Professor Eleanor Moore, who is associate professor of sociology at the University of Cape Town. Let me greet both my guests. Professor Hau, thank you very much for joining us, sir. I really appreciate it.
Yes, good evening and good evening to your listeners.
Much appreciated.
Thank you for inviting me.
Really, really appreciate you honoring the invitation. Professor Eleanor Moore, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, good evening, and thanks for the invite, and good evening to the listeners too.
Much appreciated. Prof Moore, I know that you have another commitment, so you'll stay with us just for a few minutes. But I do want to start with Professor Hau Ngubane just to get a sense of how to understand polygamy as it is practiced within our borders, and then perhaps we'll ask you to give us a context, the constitutional context in which all of that is taking place. Will that be okay, Professor Moore?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Professors Hau Ngubane, thank you very much. I always say that the only thing that is dark about Africa is our ignorance of Africa. And one of the things that is an issue of much contention because of various influences and understandings is the issue of polygamy. I started off by saying that it is a universally practiced custom, yeah? But what is unique about the African form of polygamy, if indeed it is. And maybe you can even zoom even further and look at South Africa and the various indigenous ethnic groups that are here that practice that particular custom. What is unique about it, and is it still relevant?
Yes, thank you very much. This is quite an interesting topic, and I'm glad that you have started with the statement saying that it's universal, because it is always associated with African people, and yet it is practiced by many other countries such as Malaysia, India, Philippines, Singapore. Polygamy there.
The United States of America?
No, United States of America, they don't recognize it. It's illegal. But these other countries that are highlighted, polygamy is legal.
I see.
And South Africa and Nigeria, polygamy is allowed under customary law. You may remember, and your listeners may know, that the African Customary Marriages Act was passed in 1988, which is Act Number 120, which allows and recognizes customary marriages. And by customary marriages, you are affording yourself to have more than one wife. So that is why here in South Africa, it is still practiced in a legal way, because the wife or the second wife will have equal rights to the first wife. So that is why for men who chooses to have more than one wife, it is legal for them to apply this act.
Tell us about the historical background, if you can, Prof, to the very existence of polygamy here and some of the rationale that is used for its existence.
Okay, yes, I think the rationale for this, there are good reasons for it if you look it in the traditional practices compared to contemporary practices, because we know that culture evolves and it's always dynamic. But in the past, the reasons or the justification for polygamy was for quite numerous reasons. I'll just mention two. One was the remedy for the problem of infertility. If you are married to a wife, I think for no other reason, if there is infertility, it was always a woman that was blamed and not the man. So that is why the man will take a second wife, and if the second wife is successful in having children, then that will result in a polygamy. Because in our marriage, the contract is open-ended. There was no divorce in our customary marriage. So you can't divorce a wife because of infertility.
What happens if the second wife doesn't have children?
You take the third wife.
And what happens if the third wife doesn't have children?
No, there were solutions that they used to come up with. Like, they would arrange a relative of the family to try and assist and engage in a sexual relationship with the wife. Like in the past, men usually worked far away from home, though a man will always be informed that he must come down home because there is something happening to the wife. After they have done that process of getting somebody who is within the family so that the child will carry the same surname. So that is how they used to do it in the past.
So if I understand you correctly, the practice of polygamy in the context of infertility was based on the understanding, as erroneous as it is now in hindsight, yes, that the woman is the one that is infertile, not the man.
Not the men, yes. It's always been that, like that. They always think that there is always something wrong with the woman.
What do they call that? What do they call that arrangement where the family member then comes in and sleeps with the wife and impregnates her? What do they call that process? Is there a name for it?
It was a secret operation. That's why they wouldn't have a name for it, because it was done in a very, very private and exclusive manner. And it rested with the elderly women within the family. They would be the only people who knows. And the way they used to do it, they would send the wife to go and collect fuel or firewood, if you like.
Mm.
And then they arrange that man to meet the woman there. And then when she gets back, then the operation would have been accomplished.
Would it be done with the permission or the consent of the woman?
That's what I was saying, that if, during those days, it was not seen as abusive to women, because even the woman was vulnerable for not having children. So that was presented to her, and it was by her choice if she wants to go ahead with the arrangement. If she doesn't, then that was another case. And there were also cases whereby a woman would get a child outside the marriage. And even that, if it happens, a woman was not divorced. Instead, they would build a house outside the homestead, so that it's a way of punishing her for having a child outside.
All right, so Professor Sahau Ngubane, let me stop you there, and I just want to sort of thumbnail what you've just said and say that polygamy for issues of infertility. I'm sure there are other reasons for polygamy, but I do want to bring Professor Eleanor Moore into the conversation. Prof, in terms of the law, the current law, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, where does polygamy stand, and what sort of rights, based on what Professor Sahau Ngubane has just said, is there a recognition of the fact that polygamy had some of its genesis in the idea that women were infertile? How does the Constitution deal with that complexity?
Well, there are several matters there. First of all, I just want to actually reiterate and support what my colleague was just saying there. I mean, the practice, and we've just undertaken extensive research in Limpopo on the practice of polygamy. Amongst an older sample, albeit, so kind of 50 to 60-year-olds, and exactly for the reasons that you've mentioned above were the reasons for pursuing a polygamous marriage. So issues to do with separation and divorce, not being seen as legitimate, or issues of having a child outside of marriage, fertility issues. But there's also very other practical reasons, such as preserving a rural home, where maybe an adult son is in Johannesburg and there is a need to have a rural wife, for example, look after a mother. And in other instances, I should say that wives request assistance within households.
Yes.
So it's not only always from the male's prerogative,
yes,
but often from the female's prerogative that they seek an additional woman to come into the relationship. So we shouldn't think of polygamy as anti-woman in any means. You know, whilst there obviously may be cases where there's discrimination and there may be consent, in our research we see that much of the practices on the ground, albeit from an older sample, you know, so these are practices being undertaken 30 years ago, even before, you know, the new constitution, let's say, there was always consent. There was always the consultation between the husband, I say always, obviously, you know, there will always be outliers, but there was consultation between husband and the first wife or the second wife. And there were participation, so not just consultation, but participation from the first wife and subsequent wives in the celebrations, in, you know, negotiations, but the celebrations that followed.
Yes.
So that's a very important point to think about when we come to the RCMA and the recognition of polygamous marriages as a form of a customary marriage.
Mm.
Because we see with the recognition of customary marriage that what it tried to do is it tried to remove discrimination that might take place when a subsequent wife comes along to a marriage. So when there's an existing monogamous marriage, like a husband and a wife, and the point comes where the second wife comes along, the Constitution and ensuing legislation decide, well, we need to break at that point, make sure, first of all, that the first wife's consent is there to the subsequent wife coming
yes.
to the marriage, but also we need to negotiate for kind of property arrangements so that each wife and the family more broadly would kind of have an equal say in how the financial arrangement would work. So it is the first wife has the ability at the point in which a second or a subsequent wife enters, she has the ability to say, I'm not happy with this. That doesn't mean she'll divorce necessarily, but she is allowed at that point, when I say allowed, she's entitled and she has the right to arrange her property affairs and her financial affairs in ways that suit her. Now, in reality, you know, this doesn't really happen. It actually probably happens on the ground in practical ways, more so than in legal, you know, contracts that are registered with the Master of the High Court. So what is expected to happen is there is meant to be an antenuptial contract that takes place, you know, that kind of arranges the financial affairs when subsequent wives come in. But we see very few of these contracts being registered. I think there's only a handful so far, and this is, you know, 10 years later.
In 2017, I see there was a case where the Constitutional Court confirmed that a law that governs matrimonial property in customary marriages, which discriminates against certain categories of women, is unconstitutional. Do you have any line of sight of this particular case and what was going on there?
Say that to me again. In 2017.
So in 2017, in fact, let me quickly read it to you, and we'll continue. Section 7(1) of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act of 1998 provides that wives who entered into customary marriages before the act was passed do not have marital property rights. In this case, this was the particular case that I'm talking about. Musenwa Nechituka, who died in 2008, had entered into polygamous customary marriages with three women and two civil marriages with two other women. One of the civil marriages to Martha Nechituka was terminated by divorce in 1984, while another civil marriage to Munyadziwa Nechituka in 1997 was declared null and void by the Supreme Court of Appeal in 2011. And then some of the wives were able to get a portion of the estate of the deceased husband, and some weren't. How does the law work in terms of those property issues?
Yeah, well, we have similar cases. I'm not familiar with that particular case, but we have similar cases in Muslim families, for example. So in Muslim families where polygamy is widely practiced, we have cases where upon the death of a husband, there's a contestation over who gets what and who is seen as a wife, particularly in the case where Muslim marriages are still not recognized. And that's what we're fighting for in the Muslim Marriage Bill. And in that case, the court has taken the line that a spouse is a spouse, whether it's in a Muslim marriage or not, that once you're seen to be a spouse, that you're entitled to a share in the property. So the court has, despite the lack of recognition of Muslim marriages, kind of bestowed the entitlement or the rights to multiple partners or spouses, even in Muslim marriages. As in, you can't discriminate against a spouse based on a religious marriage.
So is that...
In the case of Milani, it's the same in an African customary marriage.
Yes.
So, and that came up, but that's a post-1994 marriage, as
yes.
you rightly point out yourself.
Right.
You're right, there is discrimination amongst customary marriages that were enacted prior to the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, where subsequent wives are not treated in the same way as a first wife.
So... As it stands at the moment, only after 1998 do all of the wives get recognized as wives and materially so. But before then, if you were not married according to the, I suppose, the stipulated law at the time, well, toughies for you, huh?
Yeah, and that's a problem. And I suspect some of those women would be entitled, you know, to bring a constitutional court case, or to bring a case at least, and I think there would be much support for that. And I suspect the legislation will be amended to accommodate such marriages. And we must remember at the moment there is an attempt to create one single piece of legislation that encompasses all marriage types.
Yeah.
So instead of having separate statutory kind of legislation and protection for different types of marriages, it's all going to come into, there is an argument and a move and an approach to build, to put this all under the one umbrella. I should say that it's really important to remember that regardless of what the courts do, because what the courts do is only one element of what happens in society. What we see on the ground, and this is where we have done research ourselves with my colleague Professor Hamunga on polygamous marriages, is that people on the ground have ways of making arrangements,
yes,
property arrangements are,
yes,
equitable. They may not be entirely equal,
yeah,
but that each spouse, and particularly each wife, is catered for and treated, you know, in a way that is respects her dignity and upholds her position in that marriage.
I suppose though, Prof, that it is in those situations where that doesn't happen that we need the law to step in. And if the law is not equal to the task, then we have a problem in that people are unfairly treated and discriminated against.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let me bring Prof. Sihao Ngubane back into the conversation. Prof, you were still explaining to me that traditionally the reason for marriage, a polygamous marriage, had something to do with infertility, but most of the time, or all of the time, it was assumed that it was the woman that was infertile because just the thinking wouldn't allow the very possibility that a man could be be infertile. What other reasons are there for polygamy other than that?
Okay, quickly, let me concur or reiterate what the professor has said, that there is a consent from both sides, and these extra marriages are negotiated. In any African transaction, negotiations come first. There is something that is called a sororate marriage, where if the first wife cannot bear children, that wife will decide to bring a sister,
yes,
or a cousin to join them in the marriage. So
yes,
it is something that is practiced even in the Old Testament. If you read the Bible,
yes,
the story of Abraham
and Esther and Hagar,
yes, it was almost the same thing, because Sarah could not have children, and then Abraham had to get a
But let me stop. Let me stop you there, Prof. Are you therefore suggesting then?
Yes.
That in a polygamous marriage there would be different status. In other words, the first wife and the second wife, and sometimes the concubine. Because if I understand the story of Hagar properly, which is the one that you're referencing, she wasn't actually a wife. She was a concubine. Are you suggesting to me that there's different status for the different wives?
Yeah, that case, maybe it was a wrong example, because Hagar was not a wife. But in the African setup, the second woman becomes a wife.
But we do know and that in the African...
A legitimate wife, because of the customary law that the professor has just explained. But maybe the example was not appropriate, because King David, most of the kings, it depends on the social status of the men. Some men, like in the middle class, rich people, would have more wives because they can afford.
Yeah.
But may I also continue and give you another
example
of infertility. Also, the polygamy was viewed as a solution in the event of menopause.
Yes.
When a woman has reached that stage, then a man would still be full of energy to get another wife. So that was also one of the reasons. And also, it was also a remedy during pregnancy.
So when you say, you need to fast for me, Prof. So when you say that the man was still full of energy, you mean that he was still sexually active, as opposed to the wife who perhaps might be a little more reticent as far as sexual activity is concerned. And in that particular context, the older wife would then give consent and say, bring in a younger woman who'll be able to take the energy of my husband.
Yes, we also have a name for that.
Please,
you do that. You take into your kukela.
Into your kukela, the home of your aging.
Yes,
that's a direct translation.
That's the direct translation. But this was the permission was granted by the first wife.
Professor Eleanor Moore, the fundamental reasons, as explained by Professor Ngubane, for marriage seem to be motivated mostly by that which the man wants, that which the man can afford, that which the man is able to do or can't do, that which... Does the current law or constitution recognize that about customary polygamous marriages? And is there any protection for women in the case where the man is not a nice man? Now, I did hear you, Professor Eleanor Moore, saying to me that in most cases, the customary polygamous marriage has got self-management mechanisms, right? But that would be under the circumstances where the man, who seems to be the one who has the stronger power relations in this relationship, based on what the professor Ngubane is saying, that would be okay if the man is not cruel. What happens though when he is not cruel? How does the law protect the woman?
I think we all have to remember that this isn't like a dyad. You know, it's not a man-woman-only affair.
Yeah.
When we talk about polygamous marriages, we're talking about multiple players, never mind, you know, two families at least. But you're also talking about potentially, you know, two women, a first wife, a second wife, and maybe a subsequent third wife.
Yeah.
So we've got power relations between, yes, the husband and the first wife, but
yes,
we've also got very strong power relations between each of the wives.
Mm.
And that relationship and those relationships, depending on how many wives there are, often get overlooked.
Yes.
They themselves are some of the most powerful relationships, both for principles of solidarity and respect and kind of cooperation, but also for things like you're talking about, for abuse or for harm or for, you know, taking advantage of. So, for example, we found recently that actually the first wife plays a key role in negotiating and facilitating the process of consent of subsequent wives, and particularly when the third or the fourth wife comes along. And at that point, negotiations are had, consultations are had, you know, and this is where the first wife in particular, and also the second wife, get to bargain what they want, how they want it, and why they want it a particular way. And I think when we overlook those dynamics, we either just focus on the law or we just focus on the man and woman as one couple or as a couple, we forget that there are multiple players involved.
Now,
explain
to me, Professor Moore, how in the case of a man who has decided that he wants to take a second wife or third wife, let's say third wife, because... maybe the understanding has been established in this particular family that it is okay to have a polygamous situation. Let's say that the man wants to take a third wife, and listen to my language, wants to take a third wife, and has maybe made that decision that he's going to do so, but the first and second wife are not ready for the acceptance of the third wife into the family unit. What powers does the second and third wife bring to bear to negotiate successfully for whatever then transpires to transpire in a way that is in favor for the first and the second wife. What leverage do they have?
So remembering that this is, you know, a customary process. So
yes.
They have mechanisms they can resolve this at the kind of family level, you know, at the community level, but then also at the kind of high court or, you know, more common law level, let's call it that. So they've got mechanisms through kind of extra state systems, such as I said, the family. So they can obviously talk to the husbands, they can display their grievances, talk to the husband's family, display their grievance, have a family meeting. That's what one would do in the first instance, I suspect. You know, and that's what we find. That's the kind of first protocol, or the first place one goes to just show they're not happy with something.
Yes.
Following that, if they're still unhappy, they can bring it to a traditional leader, for example. It's usually very unlikely that actually traditional leaders hear these types of cases anymore. So what one would do is one would bring it to court. A state court. And in doing so, they can show that they didn't consent to this process. Because consent by the wife, the second wife or the third wife, and this is why we have the recognition of customary marriages, because nowadays you're expected to register your customary marriage. You know, you're obligated to do so. Now, not doing so, as you've spoken previously, doesn't mean you have an invalid customary marriage.
Yes.
But the one reason for the registration is that women who enter into customary marriages can see if they are now the second wife or a subsequent wife.
Is legal recourse.
Exactly. I mean, that's the intention. Now, in reality, lots of people don't register the marriage. So you may find yourself being married to someone and only upon their death, or maybe when you want to divorce them, do you realize actually he was actually married to someone else all along, you know, and I'm the second wife.
Yes.
But the whole idea of the recognition of customary marriages and the registration of customary marriage is to try and prevent
these surprises.
Is that it's there to protect women, and be it first wives, second wives, or subsequent wives, in knowing that this, that you are entering into a polygamous marriage as the second wife or as the third wife.
Prof,
and that not only that, but you are signing up for a customary marriage as opposed to a civil marriage, because you are open to the idea of having a polygamous. I mean, that's the main difference between a civil marriage and a polygamous marriage.
Indeed.
All the other entitlements are exactly the same.
Indeed. All right. Professor Ngubane, so the issue of infertility is the first reason that that you've told us about for the entering into a polygamous marriage. Yeah. Then you talked about the issue of menopause. For example, any other reasons? And I'll tell you why I'm sort of probing for the reasons for why people will get into a polygamous marriage. Any other reasons?
The other reason could be a desire for continuity or lineage, because it is a desire that you have a boy child, so that you keep the clan, or to keep the family continuing.
Yes.
In other words, I'm trying to explain lineage. So that is one of the reasons that people will want to have a second and third wife.
In fact, the very popular reality TV show Uthando Nesithembu with the Mselego family is very, very apt, perhaps, to talk about at this point. In fact, I've interviewed Mr. Mselego a few months ago. The whole idea of wanting to create a deeper, wider lineage by taking more wives and having more children with them. For what reason? Why? So for example, let's take the case of Ubaba Mselego. He's got sons with other wives. Why would he desire more if the expressed reason is to have sons that will continue his name? Why more?
There are quite a number of reasons. One is for wealth, that's for economic reasons. I just want you to give you one example.
Yeah.
There is a man from Umkhanyakude district in KwaZulu-Natal.
Yes.
Who has got 15 wives and 55 children. And some of these wives are 20, 21 years old, and they are still bearing more children, because he believes that if he has children, he's a businessman, he's running tech, he's in the tech industry, he's got a shop, he's a businessman, and he doesn't employ people from outside his household. He employs his sons and daughters are working in the business. So they feel that if you have more children, you accumulate more wealth because the children will work and bring their wealth to your house. So I think that's why there's that desire of having more children. Because if you have one child and against 55 children, then you are rich.
Yeah, so you're insured of labor that has a vested interest, yeah?
Exactly.
Prof, you know, and maybe this is just my township TV watching, book reading mentality. Do guys ever get married for love?
Yes, they do. They do, because you know the courtship period.
Yes,
that's where you express and you demonstrate your love. You just don't pick anyone. You pick somebody that you have been courting for a longer period, and then you agree that you fall in love with the person, and then once you propose marriage and the proposal is acceptable, then you go and approach your first wife. So it's not something that is just an arrangement.
Yes,
it is still the bond is. It's love.
But obviously there are instances where there are arrangements?
Yes, in the past there used to be pre-arrangement. Like if you see that there is a family that is rich because it's got many cows and cattle, then you arrange that your daughter marries that man. So sometimes there was a practice like that, which was also acceptable.
Professor Eleanor Moore, you chuckled when I asked the question about love, and I asked it for a specific reason. Many of my listeners listening to this show would have that question and not necessarily be aware, perhaps, of a different approach to the very idea of romance and love that may exist in a different context. So I asked that question because, by the way, I'm not just asking these questions for myself. I'm asking them for what I believe my listeners need to know.
Sure. But there is other reasons.
Yeah.
In society, we still frown upon divorce.
Yes.
You know, we kind of frown upon separation.
Yes.
And marriage still has the respect that other forms of relationships don't have, like certain, you know, like cohabiting relationships. Let's just say. So rather than divorce, I mean, and as my colleague says, you know, there's kind of no such thing as divorce, and I say that in quoted commas because we know there is. In reality,
yes.
But rather than divorce, when you're unhappy in a relationship, the other alternative is to have another wife.
Yes.
So you don't leave this other woman, you know, your first wife, let's say, without anything necessarily, and you don't leave her divorced. You don't divorce her necessarily.
Yes.
And therefore, she is still a married woman for all intents and purposes.
Yes.
And that comes with a certain level of recognition. Remembering also that many people, first of all, we know that polygamous marriages are, you know, on the decline in the first place. Marriage is on the decline, never mind polygamous marriage. But when many people are having children outside of marriage, and most children are had outside of marriage, it's another way also to legitimate, and I don't like that use of that.
Prof, if you can just move, if you can just move around, Prof, we lost you there.
Okay, so I'm not sure where you.
All right, let's see if we can't get Professor Eleanor Moore on a different line. We lost the professor there. Professor Eleanor Moore is suggesting that another reason why there may be multiple wife taking could be because another relationship didn't actually work out, and because the idea of divorce is not as clearly defined and institutionalized as it is, perhaps in the more Western way of doing things, people will take a wife, not necessarily because they have they love or don't love, but because maybe the other relationship didn't work so well, and because, you know, divorce doesn't really happen so much, you then take another wife. Would that be true?
Not for us as African people, because divorce is not part of the deal. When you get married, this is for life. So divorce.
No, not divorce in the. That's what I mean. I'm saying that let's say that the relationship is no longer working, even in marriage. Could it be that sometimes a man will then decide to take another wife because the relationship, the other one, is not working anymore?
That could be a possibility, but to think that you will divorce the first one is not going to happen. Even if you are not happy with the first wife, you can take a second wife, but you still have to go and get permission from the first wife.
And if she doesn't give you permission? I mean, I know a lot of guys whose first wives didn't give them permission, but they went ahead and took a second wife, third wife, fourth wife.
I think it would be better if the professor was still around, because that would be a crime to do.
Yeah? All right. Yeah, no, she's still here.
There's what we call bigamy.
Yes.
Where you get married to another woman whilst you are married at the same time. So in some countries, that becomes a crime.
Would it be a crime in South Africa?
I haven't had any cases here in South Africa, but it should be a crime, because you can't get a second wife without divorcing the first wife. So if you are having two wives simultaneously, then that's a crime.
Eleanor Moore, you're back. You were still explaining to me the dynamic of a relationship that didn't work prior to the new one, and how that can somehow, create the next marriage. Just talk to me a little bit more about that.
So we got to, a polygamous marriage, just like any other marriage, is a way of regulating relationships. So, particularly from a woman's perspective, it gives a certain level of protection. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of gender-based violence, there's a lot of domestic violence, but with a marriage comes a set of relationships that that are attached to kind of economic relations and social relations.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you're here, sorry. So let's say I enter into a marriage and it's unsatisfactory for whatever reason.
Yes.
I may desire to remain married, and my husband may go off and marry a second time, so enter into polygamous marriage.
Yes.
But I might still be better off in that position, because let's say he's a wealthy, and I don't mean a very wealthy man, but he's a man of some means, or he's in position of means. Or I get on very well with his sister, his mother, his brother, his wider family.
Yes.
They're supporting me, I'm supporting them, I have his children, for example. I may still be in a better position being the first wife, albeit he's more interested in the second wife, let's
sure.
say. And therefore, when if he passes away, and I will still be the first wife, and I will still be have a right to, have a certain position in society as his first wife, even though we no longer are, let's say, are deeply in love or deeply happy or deeply connected and see each other every day. So there's many kind of
there's a socio-economic imperative driving the idea to stay in the marriage rather than the romantic ideas of love.
Exactly.
I understand you correctly. All right, Professor Sahao Ngubane, there is, as you know, the very popular reality TV show Uthando Nesithembu. Many people are suggesting.
I watch it as well.
Yeah, I love the. I've interviewed Mr. Mselegu myself a couple of months ago. A wonderful guy. There seems to be, because of that, and I suppose because of that, the idea of polygamous marriages being sort of outlawed in popular culture seems to be done away with, the popularization of it via that kind of show. And I'm seeing a lot of young women talking about, no, they wouldn't mind being in a polygamous marriage these days.
It has become a fashion now. After people watching that show, people who like to join Mswelele's wives because the way they are treated, they've got beautiful
cars and
they've got beautiful homes.
Yes.
And I think that show has created interest and it is becoming popular.
But my question is slightly more nuanced than that, Prof. Let me try and explain. I'm of the opinion that polygamous relationships, even though not official in the legal sense, have been in existence under the radar for as long as there have been men and women. But sure, because of the emergence of shows like Thando Nesithembu, it seems to have liberated people. It seems to have freed people to come out and say, no, actually, that's an option that I'd like to take. Is that your experience? Is that your observation?
Yes, I agree with you. I concur 100%.
Professor Eleanor Moore, are we going to be seeing more and more polygamous relationships, polygamous marriages in South Africa?
Well, I think here we have to distinguish between de facto and de jure. Like, so in reality, I think we're going to have, there is a resurgence, like you're talking, of polyamory, so multiple partners,
yes,
not necessarily through a marriage relationship. And I definitely, if we're talking about official, legal, polygamous marriages, I don't think we're going to see an increase. I think we're going to see a further decline, if anything, because marriage in itself is declining.
Yes.
But I think if we talk about in reality on the what we see in social practices of people having many partners or multiple partners, I think we see it in Zimbabwe, for example. It's called small houses.
Mm.
The same phenomena. It's not legal, but there is very distinct differences, and these are the distinct differences are important.
Yes.
So in a polygamous marriage, there's no secret wife. There's no secret, partner.
Yes.
Everyone knows each other. There's an openness. There is kind of some sense of what and why and how everyone fits into the arrangement. Whereas when you have multiple partners, it's not always as open,
yes,
necessarily, unless you're actually in an open relationship. But even that doesn't mean everybody knows who everyone is, and
yes,
it's not all above board. Yeah. So I think we'll always, like you said yourself, we'll always have this notion of polyamory, like multiple lovers or multiple partners, and whether they're in a kind of a legally recognized situation or not, I don't think so.
Professor Eleanor Moore, I've got to stop you there. Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and your contribution. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Professor Eleanor Moore, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Cape Town. Professor Hao Ngubane, thank you very much for your wisdom and your guidance in this conversation. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you very much. But I wanted to end my debate by saying that it is by choice, and it is not a mandate that men should take more than one wife. So
yes,
it's by choice and affordability. If you can afford, then it's your choice. But it is a cultural practice that is acceptable, but it is not mandatory.
Professor Hao Ngubane, cultural expert and professor of African languages at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Let's take a break. When we come back, Eyewitness News.